So as many of you can tell, I am not Dave. I don't know how many of you will remember me. I used to go here a long, long time ago. But yeah, sorry, I'm just getting set up. It's been a bit of a morning. So Dad he's homesick with a cold, and I was woken up at 7:30 to try to get something ready to go, and this is what I've got. So if you don't like it, that's the way it goes. So normally at this time of year, we would be hearing sermons about like New Year's resolutions, and we have the tables open in the back where you can grab a read through the Bible in a year guide, which I highly recommend you do afterwards. Or you might hear sermons about how we don't need to keep Advent just in Advent. We can carry it out throughout the rest of the year, and we have this great time right before New Year's to remember at the end of our holidays just what Jesus means, what Jesus has done for us, and what the importance of that baby is. But for what I have prepared, I'm going to take you to somewhere a little bit warmer. I'm going to take you to all the way to Israel in if you could flip with me to 1 Samuel chapter 11. I'll be reading there in a bit, but I want to talk a little bit about December. This is a month that's full of lots of things, and I would argue December is, a lot of people would argue for October, but I would say December is probably the scariest month of the year, because not only do you have a whole lot of Christmas preparation, all this kind of stuff, but you also have the scariest thing of all, which I would call winter driving. And what I want to talk about today is this thing called fear, this thing that we all are plagued with and we all deal with every single day, whether we know about it or not. And so I want us to open with a question. And I want to ask you, what do you fear? What is it that you fear? What are you afraid of? And why are you afraid of it? I'll give you a couple seconds to think, but just think about it. What are you scared of? For some people, it might be spiders. For some people, it might be, I don't know, heights, public speaking, whatnot, failure, all these legitimate fears. But I can guarantee that the fear that I have probably overshadows yours by just a little bit. And that fear is Kennedy's dad. For those of you who don't know, Kennedy is my girlfriend, and over the years, I have gotten to know Rob, and I'm less scared of him than I was at the beginning, but now I'm more scared that he's going to overfeed me than anything else, which is a nice fear to have. But when I was first considering courting at Kennedy, as we would say if we were in the 1400s, I had to go and, you know, meet her parents, as you do. And I put it off for as long as I could because Kennedy, being the very nice, conscientious girl she is, gave me all these stories about her dad and how he's this big, stoic, manly man. He's this guy who shows up and he fills the room. He's very intense. He likes to go hunting. He likes to, one time he made his own shotgun shells and killed a bear with it because he was trying to protect some people. Or, you know, he makes his own beef jerky. He does all this kind of stuff. His name in her phone is The Rob Father, which is a name that instills fear. But I, on the other hand, I enjoy doodling. That's who I am. And so we have this discrepancy between this very large stoic man who doesn't speak much, but when he speaks, it demands power, and me, who is less of that. And so I remember very vividly pulling up into her driveway and sitting there and waiting and counting and taking deep breaths, doing breathing exercises, and, you know, prepping for the what are the intentions with my daughter kind of talks. But I walked in, and it was fine. I had nothing to be worried about. He was sitting there. He was watching the Food Network. It felt very at home for my family. But it was very nice. He walked in, we had a pleasant conversation, and I kind of just hung out with Kennedy, and it was great. And I was struggling with this type of fear. I'll get to these types of fear later, but there are, what I want you to take out of this is there are two types of fear, and what I was struggling here with was the second type of fear. And I'll explain them all later, but keep that in the back of your minds. I was struggling with the second type of fear. Now, as I asked you before, to flip to 1 Samuel chapter 11, I'm going to begin reading at verse 1, and I'm going to do the first 5 verses, and then we're going to take a little bit of a pause. So if you want to read along with me, or, you know, with your mouth closed, preferably. Okay, so Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to him, "Make a treaty with us, and we will be subject to you." But Nahash the Ammonite replied, "I will make a treaty with you only on the condition that I gouge out the right eye of every one of you and so bring disgrace on all Israel." And the elders of Jabesh said to him, "Give us 7 days so we can send messengers throughout Israel. And if no one comes to rescue, we will surrender to you." So I want to pause. Right now, we have a very complex situation going on in Israel. They're right at the end of the judges. They've been demanding a new king. And right previously to this, Saul was just appointed king. And it was kind of a bit of a lame appointing of the king. If you're familiar with the story, he was to be appointed king because he was very strong, he was very good looking, but he didn't really want to do it. He was found hiding among the luggage, and he was being a little bit of a coward ahead of this. He was not the most kingly type. But right now we have Israel in this very unfortunate situation. We have the Ammonites who have come in and they have come to take over this place called Jabesh Gilead, and Jabesh Gilead isn't doing so hot. They're asking for help, but there's no unifying thing over Israel. They're waiting for a judge, they're waiting for something, but there's no organization, and they're hoping for something. They're hoping for help. And, you know, it's not a great situation to be in. There's a couple details here we might miss. The big power of the Ammonites are giving Jabesh Gilead is you either die or you are humiliated. These are your two options. You can either fight back and we're going to completely mow you over because you can't beat us. Or you can surrender and we're going to gouge out your eyes. And something we won't get in this 21st century context is the loss of an eye. The specifically what they say here is the right eye. When you were to fight, you had a shield and you had a sword. And you had the sword covering up your left eye, and you had the shield covering your left eye, and you had a sword in your right hand, because people were generally right-handed. And so if your right eye is gone, you no longer can see. It is squashing any hope of a rebellion. It is squashing any hope of getting dignity later on. They're basically going into slavery if this doesn't go their way. And so they're in a desperate situation. They're asking for help. They're crying out for help. But there's not a lot of hope in sight. And so, if we'll continue on in verse 4, it says, "When the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and reported these terms to the people, they all wept aloud. Just then Saul was returning from the fields behind his oxen, and he asked, 'What is wrong with the people? Why are they weeping?' And then they repeated to him what the men of Jabesh had said." So here enters Saul. As I mentioned before, he had just been appointed king in the last chapter, but he enters from the field. When you picture a newly appointed king, you don't picture them as, "Hey, we're going to come in from the I'm a farmer. He's coming in from farming." He doesn't have a throne, he doesn't have a kingdom, what they were hoping for Israel. He doesn't have anything like that. He's just this guy. He was hiding in the luggage last chapter, and now he's out tending the fields. It's not the picture of a king that we're used to, but it's the picture that is presented to us here. And so this story is really, really integral in the life of Saul. But for those of you who are familiar with the story of Saul, I'd like to kind of take a step back from that. If you could forget everything you know about Saul, I just want you to remember that, first of all, he was appointed king, and second of all, here he is coming in from the fields. Everything else after this hasn't happened yet. And if you're reading this for the first time, this is what's happening. You're getting the story of Saul. 1 Samuel is this great story of Saul. And at this point, all we know about him is he's this tall man, he's been appointed king, and was hiding among the luggage. And so, continuing in verse 6. "When Saul heard their words, the Spirit of God came upon him in power, and he burned with anger.
He took a pair of oxen, he cut them into pieces and sent the pieces throughout Israel by messengers, proclaiming, "This is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel." And then the terror of the Lord fell upon the people as they turned out as one man. And when Saul mustered them at Bezek, the men of Israel numbered 300,000 and the men of Judah 30,000. This is incredible. This is an insane thing for someone to be able to do. But there are a couple things I want to pause and take a little bit of time on. First of all, we have the Spirit of God coming upon Saul in power. This is key. This is what makes the rest of this story incredible. This is what makes the rest of the story make any sense whatsoever. For it is only through the Spirit of God coming on Saul that the rest of this chapter makes any sense whatsoever. Second of all, in verse 7, he talks about chopping up some oxen and sending it out through Israel. This also has some significance that we might miss. For Jabesh-Gilead, which I'm sure very few of you remember from Sunday school, because they show up twice in the whole Bible, or two or three times in the whole Bible. But the last time Jabesh-Gilead kind of appeared in the Bible was through this tragic story where there was a summons for all of Israel to come and join together, and Jabesh-Gilead didn't show up. And so they were punished very severely as a result of that. And they were left very weak, which is why the Ammonites were able to come in and do this kind of thing right here. They were left weak because they didn't come to a summons. And yet here, the irony is that Saul has sent out these oxen and said, "Come, you need to unite, we need to save Jabesh-Gilead," which they do not deserve. They are weak right now because they didn't come to a summons, and yet all of Israel is summoning around them to save them. And it's this fascinating detail. It's this great detail. And here, right after they say that, it says, "The terror of the Lord fell on the people, and they turned out as one man." They're scared. They're scared they're going to lose their livestock. They're scared they're going to use the, they are united out of fear, which is a weird thing. It feels weird to be considering uniting under fear as the right way to do things. Usually you want to unite under something that's like positive and happy. You want to unite under a just cause. But here they're uniting under fear. "The fear of the Lord came upon the people and they came out as one man." And lastly, I want to point out what Saul says here. He says, "This is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel." He's not pointing to himself. He's pointing to himself and Samuel, the messenger of God here. Samuel is the prophet at this time, and he is pointing to the king that they've appointed and Samuel, who is the messenger of God, as who they are uniting with. And so they all came out. They unified. And I don't know how many of you have ever done management of any kind of thing, but the men of Israel numbered 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. That's a lot of people. That is a lot of people to come and gather in the course of 1 week. To get a message out to 300,000 people plus another 30,000, to get that all together and unified in the course of a week is nothing short of a miracle. This is nothing short of what could be done with the power. Like, there were no cell phones. There was no, you couldn't just put out a little Facebook message and have everyone be like, "Yeah, I'll show up," like they did with the Area 51 thing. But like, this is something completely different. This is, we're going to send out messengers, and everyone rallied together to save these people who didn't deserve it. They rallied together over the people who wouldn't rally with them before. And so here is this kind of big battle story, this big fantastic story that comes out of this, and it says, "They told the messengers who had come, 'Say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, by the time the sun is hot tomorrow, you will be delivered.' And so the messengers went and reported this to the men of Jabesh, and they were elated, naturally. They said to the Ammonites, 'Tomorrow we will surrender to you, and you can do to us whatever seems good to you.' The next day, Saul separated these men into three divisions, and during the last watch of the night, they broke into the camp of the Ammonites and slaughtered them until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together." It was a victory. It was a very clean victory. Saul, this man who doesn't have a lot of experience in this, was able to come up with military strategies. He was able to direct people. He was able to conquer this military, like a genuine military with people he had gathered in 7 days. And it wasn't Saul who did this. It was, like I said before, the Spirit of the Lord who had come upon Saul. Now, I want to pause here for a little bit because I kind of glossed over this phrase, the terror of the Lord, the fear of the Lord. I mentioned at the beginning of this that there are two types of fear. And I would like to argue, you can disagree, we could talk about it after, I'd love to discuss, but I would argue there are two types of fear. There is the fear of God and there is the fear of the world. There's the fear of God and there's the fear of the world, okay? I'm going to say it together. There's the fear of God, there's the fear of the world. The fear of God, the fear of the world. Perfect. Those are the two types of fear. And I want to classify these in a very specific way. The fear of the world is anything that's not the fear of God. The fear of the world, there are very genuine fears. They can be fears of things like spiders. They can be fears of things like failure. They can be fears of all these kind of things. But they're the fears that are very, very present in this moment. They're the fears that are very, very present in the future. But the fear of God is something completely different. And it's this weird tangible phrase that shows up numerous times throughout the Old Testament. But I would argue it's this type of reverence, this type of respect for God. When you look at the power of God and you look at the power of the world, there's a huge discrepancy there. The power of God is massive. The power of God dwarfs anything the world has to offer. And the world has a lot to offer. The world has a lot of things that we can be scared of in it. There are, I don't know what you guys said you were afraid of. It could have been anything from marriage problems. It could have been anything like, I have no idea what you guys are going through right now. We've just come out of a Christmas season, which is notoriously hard for a lot of families who have gone through losses and all these kinds of things. And we can be afraid of facing these kinds of things without the people we love. We can be afraid of all this kind of stuff. And these are genuine fears. But what I want to say to you today is the terror, the fear of the Lord, this respect for the Lord. The Lord is more powerful than anything we're going through right now. The Lord is infinitely powerful. He's omnipotent. He's omniscient. He's all these big three-syllable words that nobody really remembers the meaning of unless they've gone through 4 years of Bible college, as I have. But the Lord is endless. God is this great, powerful being, and he's willing to partner with us. He sent his son to die for us, and we didn't deserve it, much like Jabesh-Gilead. Now, before I wrap everything up, there's a little bit more to the end of this chapter that I would like to go through with you. So, starting in verse 12, chapter 11, verse 12, the people then said to Samuel, "Who was it that asked, 'Shall Saul reign over us?' Bring these men to us, and we will put them to death." But Saul said, "No one shall be put to death today, for this day the Lord has rescued Israel." And Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal, and there reaffirm the kingship." So all the people went to Gilgal and confirmed Saul as king in the presence of the Lord. They sacrificed fellowship offerings before the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. This story sounds very familiar if you've been reading through the Bible chronologically. And the reason for that is this is not a traditional king story. This story is a judge story. All the politics in Israel at this moment in time are they wanted a king, and there's this fight over whether or not they should have a king or whether God should rule over them and they should be united under God as a nation or all these kinds of things. But this story sounds an awful lot like that of Gideon. It sounds a lot like that of Ehud, Shamgar, all these famous judges who the Spirit of the Lord came upon them and they too rescued Israel. And that's what this sounds like a lot to me, at least. But here we have the reaffirming of Saul as the king. And after this, things start to change for Israel. You go through Saul, you go through David, you go through Solomon, and you go through a lot of rough kings for the rest of the Old Testament until they go into exile and all this kind of stuff. But here, is a shining point in Saul's life. Here, he says, Israel took a complete 180 here. They looked at Saul and said, who said Saul shouldn't be king? Who said that? Let's kill that guy. That's crazy. Saul's obviously very qualified. Anyone who said that, anyone who said he isn't qualified should be put to death. And Saul's like, wait a minute. No. I didn't even think I should be qualified. I hid among the luggage guys. But he then directs, and if you're familiar with Saul, you can remember it all again now. I give you permission. If you are familiar with Saul, he has a very rough road ahead of him. But here, Saul does something he doesn't always do, and he gives the glory to God. He says, no one shall be put to death today, because this day, not I, not Saul, the Lord has rescued Israel. The Lord, not Saul. Here in this moment, he was only able to accomplish what happened because he looked at the odds and he said, I fear God more than I fear the world. He looked at these insurmountable odds and he rallied together 30,300. He rallied together a lot of people in a short span of time and defeated a military power after just walking out of the field and saying, what's going on? This is what happened, and it happened because he feared God far more than he feared the world. And I want to do a brief overview over the rest of his life really quickly in the next few minutes, but what happened to Saul after this, it's tragic. The book of 1 Samuel feels a lot like Othello. It feels a lot like any of those tragic hero stories where it starts off so strong and then it just kind of, it crashes and burns. And not even a few chapters after this, Saul makes this mistake where this shift in power of what he fears most takes a drastic shift. It switches completely. Later on, Saul is met with this military conflict, and he is waiting for Samuel to come and make an offering. And he needs to wait for that offering before they can attack, but time is running out, and he's in this time crunch where he's like, we need the offering, we need to attack now. And he's thinking very, very in the terms of the world. He's thinking, well, if we're going to win a military victory, we need to go now, we need to do this and this and this. And he's not trusting in God. He's not respecting this fear of the Lord. He's afraid of this army that's coming at him. And he does something that he was commanded not to do. And he says, you know what, I'm just going to do the offering, and then we're going to go do this military victory, because if we don't go now, we're not going to win. Two chapters earlier, he just did this amazing miracle that God did through him, and it was incredible. But here, he's like, well, we need to look at the time. We gotta go. We gotta hurry up, guys. And so he does that, and right as he's doing it, Samuel walks up and says, what are you doing? You should have trusted in God. You should have trusted in the Lord. You should have feared God more than the world. And after that, his reign takes a long dive down, and at the very end of his life, if you'll turn to me to the end of 1 Samuel, we get this very, very sad image of, in chapter 31, where Saul takes his own life in a cave, alone with his shield bearer. But it's this tragic story. This man who did this great miracle and directed all the credit to God, directed all the credit to Samuel, this messenger of God, he was very humble, but his fears shifted. He feared the world. He looked at the world and said, I'm scared of what's going to happen here, and he didn't rely on God. He didn't trust in God. And at the very end of the story, we find the death of Saul. But one thing I want to point out, one shining little glimmer of hope at the end of the story is, if you'll read with me from verse 8, it says, the next day when the Philistines came in to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gibeah. They cut off his head and stripped him of his armor, and they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols among the people. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashereths and fastened his body to the wall of Beth Sharan. And when the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, when the people of Jabesh-Gilead, the one shining victory he had in his life, when the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard of what the Philistines had done to Saul, all of their valiant men journeyed through the night to Beth-shan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Beth-shan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them under a tamarisk tree, and they fasted 7 days.
Saul didn't live, he wasn't a great king. I don't think you'll find that many people who will argue that Saul was a great king. But these people didn't forget. These people didn't forget what he did. This is a long time after. This one act out of fearing the Lord, this one act where the Spirit came upon, Saul, and he saved this small tribe who didn't deserve it, they didn't forget it. They didn't miss this summons. They may have missed the one before, but they didn't miss this one. And they showed up, and they saved his body and gave him a proper burial, and they fasted for 7 days. Because they didn't forget. Saul is a tragic hero, and I don't want to just push a whole bunch of moralistic teachings onto his life. But what I think we can learn from him, what I think we need to learn from him in this new year, and the rest of for the rest of this year, if you're looking for resolutions, here's one you could do. Remember to fear God more than you fear the world, because God is so much more powerful, so much stronger, so much more everlasting. You step back and you look at the perspective. We as Christians, we believe in an eternity. And, you know, one of these is going to last that long. One of these isn't. So what are you going to put your trust in? What are you going to put your fear in? Because I can tell you, one of these is more powerful and more infinitely deserving of our trust and our respect. Thank you. I'm going to close in prayer as the worship team comes back up. Dear God, thank you for today, and thank you for all you've done for us. Thank you for the sacrifices that you've made and all the good stuff you do for us, even the stuff that we miss and we neglect and we don't notice. You care for us, and you've given us this gift of your Son, and I pray that we wouldn't forget that in this Christmas season or for the rest of the year. That we would respect your sacrifice and we would fear you in the way that you deserve. Thank you for today, and thank you for all the days that are yet to come until you do. In Jesus' name, amen.